KALW.
You never know. You might be in a rental situation that might be one of, you know, two or three or eight that are specifically affected by one of the proposed ordinance changes.
The city of Berkeley will be voting on rental issues on this year's ballot.
It's not necessarily typical to have competing ballot measures, but also not unheard of.
Then a Berkeley author shares her story about a relationship that went from friendship to romance and eventually to terror.
I think the fundamental experience of abuse is becoming estranged from yourself. You gradually let another person dictate your perceptions of what is real.
It's the next segment from Book It. I'm Henat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Bay Area voters will have their work cut out for them on November 5th. There are candidate races up and down the ballot, 10 California state propositions, and then there are the local voting measures. In Berkeley, a lot of measures this year are interwoven in ways that could potentially be confusing for voters. To try and tease out some of these knots, senior Berkeley Side reporter Alex N. Geekin spoke with KALW's Sunni Khalid.
In the city of Berkeley, there are two dueling landlord-tenant measures on the ballot. The first is the Berkeley Rent Relief and Homeowners Protection Act. That is brought by the landlords. What are the key points that voters should understand on how it's going to impact tenant rights?
Sure. So very broadly speaking, this ballot measure, which is Measure CC, it's going to curb some of the power of the city's rent stabilization board, give landlords a little more latitude to increase rent. It would also increase the rent cap of 7% year-to-year to 7.1% year-to-year, give landlords the ability to agree or mutually agree with tenants to raise rent when there are increases in services or amenities, and expand some rent control exemptions to more property types, particularly when landlords live on site or when landlords only own two or fewer properties within Berkeley.
Well, not to be outdone, there's another measure which is put forward by the Berkeley City Council, and that's the Berkeley Tenant Protection and Right to Organize Act. What is in this measure, and why do the supporters say we need to have it?
So this is Measure BB, which began as an initiative petition from members of the elected Rent Stabilization Board. That never got enough signatures, but the City Council revived the substance of the proposal for the most part. So this proposal would cap rent increases at 5% year over year. It would set aside housing for funding retention, which the landlord's measure would also do, although in a different format, under an appointed commission. And so, of course, you know, proponents of BB, which is more geared towards renters protection, have cited the very high cost of living in Berkeley, which I'm sure is no surprise to Bay Area listeners that housing is expensive here. I think the average home value in Berkeley was just under $1.4 million this year. Median rent is $1,895 for a studio and $2,200 for a one bedroom. That's according to Zillow. So all in all, it was sort of slow, the progressive increase in rents in Berkeley.
Well, if both measures pass, what happens then? Can they coexist? Would one cancel out the other?
Since both ballot measures apply to the same section of Berkeley's municipal code, there's a section of California election code, which I believe allows for situations like this. And it says if two ballot measures compete, which is to say they affect the same thing essentially, then whichever garners the highest number of votes will prevail or control. So in a scenario where both of these ballot measures win, each receives more yes votes than no votes, the one with the higher vote count will be put into effect and the other one will not be.
All right. Well, anyone who lives in Berkeley or drives through Berkeley knows that we have a problem with streets and sidewalks. And there are two different proposals for funding streets and sidewalks on the Berkeley ballot. Only one can pass, and it must have majority of the vote. So let's talk about both of those. One is the Fix Streets and Sidewalk Initiative tax. Who is behind the measure and what will it do for the city?
So the organization which began this ballot measure, which is Measure EE, they're called Berkeleyans for Better Planning, and they organized to defeat Measure L in 2022. That would have been a $650 million bond measure, which wouldn't just have funded infrastructure, it would have also funded affordable housing and other projects, but opponents at the time thought it was too much of a blank check for the city, and it didn't hit the, I believe, two-thirds threshold it needed to pass. So EE would raise parcel taxes in Berkeley, 13 cents per square foot across the city, which is just a little little bit less than $200 for a 1,500 square foot home. It's projected to raise $144 million over 12 years. And the folks who have proposed it have pitched it as a sort of common sense, no frills approach to dealing with Berkeley's streets and walkways, which really aren't great.
Now, the other measure is safe streets, which means sustainable and accountable funding for equitable street transformation, revitalization enhancements, and essential traffic study. That's a mouthful. Why do supporters say this is the way to go?
The pitch behind what's called safe streets is that the competing measure, fix the streets and sidewalks, doesn't go far enough and doesn't provide for the type of safety infrastructure construction that the safe streets proponents would like to see. So this is a bifurcated parcel tax, 17 cents per square foot on residential properties, 25 cents per square foot on other properties. They're projecting $235 million over 14 years. They got backing from groups like the Berkeley Firefighters Association, the Sierra Club, and the League of Women Voters. Whereas Fix the Streets and Sidewalks sort of does what the name says, which is to focus mainly on the streets and sidewalks that are already there and, you know, other walkways, pathways, ways of transit that already exist. The Safe Streets Initiative would involve some more construction of safety measures like bulb outs, raised crosswalks, medians, and so on.
Is it typical to have two measures battling on the same ballot?
It's not necessarily typical to have competing ballot measures, but also not unheard of. At least as recently as 2016, measures U1 and DD competed to change how the city levied business taxes on rental properties. And actually, what one of the organizations that is pushing for the Homeowners Protection Act this year, which is the Berkeley Property Owners Association, raised almost $900,000 trying to defeat U1 and promote DD. And U1 is ultimately what prevailed.
The term inside baseball is used when it's difficult for people to keep track of how much is going on, when, and where. You are covering this. You are our expert on inside baseball. What is it like for the actual players, the residents and voters in Berkeley, to keep up in unpacking the pros and cons of these various proposals?
I don't know if everybody in the stadium gets to be a player, but this definitely has a lot of people catching foul balls, and you really don't want to miss one when it comes at you. So I would say, you know, read the text of the proposed ordinance changes, not just what's going to be printed on the ballot, not just the arguments for and against. Really get into the nitty-gritty of the municipal code, because you never know. You might be in a rental situation that might be one of, you know, two or three or eight that are specifically affected by one of the proposed ordinance changes, or maybe one of the bulb outs is going to make your street a little safer or a little more difficult to navigate. Certainly take the time to read through your ballot information. After all, it's your tax dollars at stake.
That was Alex N. Geekin, a senior reporter from Berkeley Side, speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. You can find all our election coverage at KALW.org/2024elections. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Up next, it's another segment from Book It, our ongoing author interview series with KALW's Angie Coiro. Today's installment is a hard listen with deep insights into a tough subject, domestic violence. Please take care while you listen. Here's Angie.
Yeah, Hannah, this week's book is A Survivor's Education, Women, Violence, and the Stories We Don't Tell. Berkeley author Joy Neumeier was a UC Berkeley graduate student in Russian and Eastern European history when her relationship with a friend shifted into romance, and from romance into terror. She juggled days and nights of violence with work on her thesis and her duties as a teacher's assistant. She parallels the characters and events of Russian history with the shifting alliances of her friends and colleagues as she fought her way out of the relationship. Ultimately, she pursued action against her abuser under Title IX protections against gender-based discrimination. Our conversation includes vivid descriptions of physical violence and suicidal ideation. Please be advised, this is an important but difficult conversation with adult language. It starts with how her relationship began its turn into brutality.
I think the fundamental experience of abuse is becoming estranged from yourself. You gradually let another person dictate your perceptions of what is real. And it begins slowly at first. You know, before this person laid a hand on me, they became completely obsessed with the men I had gone out with in the past and kind of worrying that I would get back together with them or reject him or something like that. And, you know, I assuaged him. You know, no, you're the one I really want. So we had already entered into this dynamic where he was creating a narrative. There were fears he had. He needed to be comforted. Mm-hmm. And it was my role to provide that comfort. So all of that was already in place before physical violence entered the picture. And then once it did, the first time he initially denied it and said he hadn't touched me at all, which of course was absurd. Then he switched tactic. You know, he went through several kind of rounds. But one, the tactic that he would ultimately always come back to, which I think is very common, was to cry, to kind of put on this childlike demeanor, which was so completely at odds with the incandescent rage that he had been projecting mere moments before. And suddenly you see this person in front of you who you care about, who looks vulnerable, right, who needs comfort, and you're used to comforting them. So it's just incredible how without even consciously realizing it, you can lose your grip over reality and your perception of what is appropriate and healthy and normal.
I want to talk about the role of shame, which shows up as a recurrent theme through the book. And part of it manifested when you were trying to, you were kind of trying to and kind of trying not to reach out for some support from your friends, which is a natural source of support, but you didn't really want to disclose to them what was going on. Was that purely shame?
I think I was so focused. I was so lost in this other person. I wanted to protect him. I think that was really driving a lot of the self-censorship, frankly, that I was engaged in. Because I felt that my life was unraveling before me and I desperately needed someone to help tug me out of these sinking waters. But at the same time, we were kind of colluding together in covering up everything that was happening. And of course, he took the lead in this. You know, he would only hurt me physically when no one else we knew was around. But I, in my deluded way, participated. I thought he was going to get better, quote unquote.
And he went to therapy.
He went to therapy, as I asked. So I thought any moment now, we're going to put this all behind us. Spring has arrived. We can forget all of the sorrows of winter. And I didn't want any reminders of what he had done to linger after he had completed this transfiguration into a completely different person. So I did my best to say as little as possible until I frankly became so terrified that I couldn't hold back anymore. And in hindsight, I think I actually conveyed a lot more than I intended to through my body language, through the fact that I sort of disappeared from a lot of the places where I would usually spend time.
Yeah.
There were signs that were beyond my control and I think already started to draw a picture if you had been looking closely.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that we're not funny. It's ironic. We're this far into what began as the women's movement and then Me Too and all of those. We're still in an arena where people examine the woman to find out what the heck was wrong with her that she stayed. We're still doing that. Once you started to realize that he was not going to change, I wonder if that played any part in your feelings, in your trying to get away, in your not trying to get away. Was there any self-blame going on?
Oh, absolutely. Because his narrative always came down to one thing. I was the perpetrator and he was the victim. And this was so firmly implanted in my brain. Every time he had a reason for why he was upset, it was always over something I had done. It was my fault. It was my job to make it up to him, to take care of him. So I felt really guilty. And he had, you know, he was a very skilled manipulator, as many abusive people are. He had particular buttons he knew to push, you know, talking about his experiences of being abused as a child. If you hear those things, it's very powerful. He would threaten to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, no one wants someone they care about to kill themselves. It's an extremely powerful manipulative tactic.
Right. It's time for you to take care of him again.
Yeah, exactly. And why did he want to kill himself? Because I had been such a whore, as he would have put it.
Here's another quote from the book. At night, Daniel tells me he's going to choke me to death. Holding my neck with one hand, he tries to raise his hand to his throat with the other. His fingers dig in my wrist as I struggle with him. The next morning, I put on long sleeves and try to forget. I have to go hold office hours. What an immense burden to have to push down and say, all right, student, tell me how it's going with you.
Absolutely. I, like many people who go into a PhD program, had always been straight A student, especially in the humanities. It was my passion. I don't think you start studying this kind of thing unless you really love it and work hard at it. So I had been used to excelling, for lack of a better word. And as soon as all of this started happening, I felt my brain disintegrate.
Hmm.
The mental load of trying to make sense of this bewildering mess that was constantly surrounding me was just too much. I started to have these psychosomatic headaches where I would see colors. It was sort of like shimmering cut glass that would cloud my vision. And whenever I would have a spare moment to myself to be alone, if I would sit down in my apartment, if I would be in the library and open a book, my head would spin. It was dizzying. I was no longer able to intake information in the way that I used to be able to. And at the same time as I was losing my ability to articulate what felt to me like pretty much anything, I saw my abuser becoming stronger. He was feeding off of this.
Ugh.
And I think it definitely affected my teaching, my relationships with my students. I was completely mentally not there when I was teaching class.
Yeah.
At the end of the semester, I had to ask someone to fill in for me because I was hiding from my boyfriend who was stalking me around the campus. And this was only after a few months. You know, I really shudder to think if I would have existed at all or what shell of a person I would have turned into after years of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Eventually comes along in the context of what happened within your studies, and you discovered a pair, an actor and his wife, Oleg and Liza. Tell us about them and your sense of discovery reading about them.
Yeah, it was a very uncanny experience. So at the same time as the Title IX investigator was reading my emails and text messages and trying to figure out what, if anything, happened to me, I was off in Moscow after I had left this relationship and filed a Title IX complaint, doing research for my dissertation. And as part of that, my job was to read the personal correspondence of other people and make judgments about their lives and create some kind of narrative surrounding it. So this felt like a very safe kind of voyeuristic position, which historians, frankly, often occupy. You know, we judge the past from a safe remove. And suddenly I was going through some correspondence in an archive, and I found a reference by this woman, Liza's mother, to how this Soviet actor, Oleg, really loved Liza, but when he was drunk, he would turn into an animal. And one time he strangled her. And I thought, wait a minute, I had not been expecting to see this. And a few months ago, I had been strangled by my partner. It sort of came out of nowhere. And I was just desperate to learn more about what had happened here. So I read all of the letters that I could find in the archive that were written by this woman, this man, their mother's letters as well. And it was so reminiscent of my own experience because in all of her letters, Lisa never mentions an act of violence. But I recognized all of the euphemisms she used, how quickly she would become overjoyed to think that he had changed, how vague she would be in her allusions to the contrary. I remember she wrote this line that really haunts me. It was bad. Depression, fear, etc. And I know what that etc. is.
Now, you two spoke in the same code.
Yeah, we spoke in the same code. Exactly.
Mm. How did you get to be from the person who kept trying to fix this, who kept trying to make it right and nurture him, to the woman who decided to file a Title IX complaint? What was that last shoe that dropped, that last drop?
There was one final thing that led me to break with him permanently. When I was in Berkeley and we had gotten back together, my mom called me. And she told me that she had just talked to a family friend of ours who had gone to her niece's funeral. This woman had been killed by her husband. He ran into her with his truck. And this woman was about my age. And this had just happened. Mm-hmm. And my mom said to me, I don't want to have to go to your funeral. When she said that, I didn't immediately take it to heart. But the last night I spent with my abusive boyfriend, I thought he was going to kill me. I thought I was going to die. And as I stealthily prepared my departure after that night, I really felt like I didn't have the strength to leave him. I was too wrapped up in his narrative. I was too used to thinking of him as the victim. I didn't have the strength to do it. I didn't have the will. And then I thought back to that phone conversation with my mom and that woman around my age who had died. And I thought, I'm going to do it for her. I'm going to live the life that she didn't get to have. And being able to think of someone else, finding someone else to attach my energy and emotion to who was not him, who, like me, was a fellow actual victim of domestic violence, is what propelled me to get on that plane out of Berkeley and start totally reconfiguring my life.
Joy Neumeyer is a journalist and historian, focusing on Russia and Eastern Europe. We've been discussing her book, A Survivor's Education, Women, Violence, and the Stories We Don't Tell. Help is available for domestic violence victims and those struggling with trauma. The National Domestic Violence Hotline has phone, chat, and text options at thehotline.org. The Suicide and Crisis Hotline is at 988-LIFELINE.org. Hana?
Thanks, Angie. Book It returns next week with guest Jessica Carew Kraft and her book, Why We Need to Be Wild, One Woman's Quest for Ancient Human Answers to 21st Century Problems. Today's Cross Currents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Crystal Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Maris Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.